The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Good morning, everybody. First of all, congratulations to the class of 2009, those of you who are here, for a job well done. If I could give you extra credit, I would, for being here this morning, but I can't. When I was asked to do the seminar this morning, it didn't really take me long to decide exactly what I was going to do. The substance of what you're going to hear this morning was presented on the occasion of my inauguration as professor of practical theology 2.5 years ago, exactly to the day. And I've chosen to revisit it for several reasons. First of all, save me a little work at this busy time of the academic year. Second of all, I think you'll find in God's providence that it's going to dovetail very nicely with Dr. Waugh's presentation that follows. Thirdly, after the initial presentation of this material in the past, somehow the faculty of Covenant Theological Seminary got a hold of it and used it as the basis of faculty discussion there to assess their effectiveness in preparing pastors. And more recently, our faculty has begun to discuss this material, particularly the four imperatives with which I conclude the lecture. And it's a joy for us to have had two substantive discussions thinking together about our effectiveness in preparing pastors. And finally, when I preach at at Crossroads Church on Sunday mornings, there are two services, and I often find that preaching the second time goes a little better than the first time. So I hope that as I revisit this material this morning, that will be the case as well. So if the key to the advance of the kingdom of our Lord is through the church, then the proper preparation of under-shepherds to lead his flock is crucial. In Matthew 9, as Jesus moved from village to village and looked across the faces of harassed and helpless people, he felt compassion for the people because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Excuse me. It was then that he said, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest." As William Still reminds us, quote, "The pastor by definition is a shepherd, the under-shepherd of the flock of God. His primary task is to feed the flock by leading them to green pastures. He also has to care for them when they are sick or hurt and seek them when they go astray. The importance of the pastor depends on the value of the sheep." What does the church need? What has the church always needed? Pastors who are shepherds. How will they be trained? How will they be prepared and equipped? There is actually a small mistake in the program this morning, because the title of the lecture should have a question mark at the end. Seminary, a place to prepare pastors, question mark. And if you're graduating today and are moving toward pastoral ministry, you certainly hope the answer to that question is yes. But there seems to be a question mark about this in the minds of many. More recently, the words of John Frame. He writes, "It seems to me that most seminary graduates are not spiritually ready for the challenges of the ministry. Seminaries not only frequently refuse to do the work of the church, they also tend to undo it." In an article published in the Christian Century, Edward Farley bemoans the fact that despite years of internal self-analysis and external pressure from the church and creditors, little has changed in addressing the ineffectiveness of seminaries in training pastors. So, should there be a question mark or not? Is the seminary an effective place to prepare pastors or not? More specifically to us, is this seminary an effective venue for training pastors? Well, how I hope to proceed this morning, I hope to affirm indeed that this seminary is a place that prepares pastors effectively. But to lay the foundation for this, I would like to give you a little bit of a historical background in terms of pastoral training in America, how we got to where we are, and then I would like to take a drink of water. Thank you very much. Thank you. I want to look at a couple of the basic patterns that identified pastoral training in the United States, what led up to the establishment of the seminary movement, and then talk about four imperatives that are crucial if we are to answer the question yes as to whether the seminary. I think I needed something a little stronger, Leah. All right. The theological seminary is a relative latecomer in models of ministerial training in America. And it was hoped to have been the hybrid of the best of the two earlier models. And so the first of the earlier models was the academic model. The first generations of pastors in the colonies naturally received their training in the old country. However, as the population in the New World grew, it became desirable to establish local institutions to prepare the next generation for pastoral ministry. The first colleges in America were created for the purpose of providing pastors for the growing communities in the colonies. For example, in an early brochure for Harvard published in 1643, it justified the college's existence, quote, to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches. Samuel Simpson, in Early Ministerial Training in America, adds, it was with reference, first of all, to the suitable training of ministers that the courses of study at Harvard were arranged. How things change. Though they followed the medieval academic template of the European universities, it was clear that preparation for pastoral ministry was their mission. And according to Quincy's History of Harvard, quote, the exercises of the students had the aspect of a theological rather than a literary institution. They were practiced twice a day in reading the scriptures, giving an account of their proficiency in and experience in practical and spiritual truths, accompanied by theoretical observations on the language and logic of the sacred writings. They were carefully to attend to God's ordinances and be examined on their profiting, commonplacing the sermons, and repeating them publicly in the hall. He also notes that the subjects for study included logic, physics, etymology, syntax, ethics, politics, geometry, composition, and Hebrew. Greek was a requirement for admission. And more than half of Harvard's graduates in its first century of existence became pastors. But even those graduates didn't go into pastoral ministry immediately, but stayed at the college for the purpose of advanced study in theology. In his classic work on the training of the Protestant ministry in the United States, William Shoemaker writes, whatever may have been the number of exceptions, it was in this earlier period the custom among the Congregationalists of America for the graduate intending to study for the ministry to return to Harvard for 2 years, more or less, of study in divinity. The practice was common at Yale as well. After graduating from Yale in 1720, for example, Jonathan Edwards stayed on for 2 years at the college to pursue theological studies. At Harvard in 1721 and Yale in 1756, the first professorships of divinity were established. At Yale, this came about as a result of the impact of the Great Awakening. A need was seen for the faculty to be entrusted specifically with the care and instruction of students preparing for the ministry. But as time went on, the majority of congregational and Presbyterian candidates moved in training in a different direction, moving toward the use of private teachers or apprentices. So the first model we could call the academic model, though not mutually exclusive to this one. The second model is the apprenticeship model. Toward the middle of the 18th century, a new practice began among the Congregationalists and then among the Presbyterians, which experienced pastors would take candidates for ministry not only into their care, but oftentimes into their homes. One of the first and most notable of these was Congregationalist pastor Joseph Bellamy of Bethlehem, Connecticut, whose ministry is described in this way in Sprague's Annals of the American Pulpit. Quote, from the time that Mr. Bellamy resumed the stated charge of his flock at the close of his labors as an itinerant, he commenced assisting young men in their theological studies preparatory for the ministry. And in this department of labor, he soon became highly distinguished. Many of the most eminent ministers of New England of that period were trained in a great measure under his instruction. It was his custom to furnish his students with a set of questions covering the whole field of theology, then to give them a list of books corresponding to the several subjects which they were to investigate, and then, in the progress of their inquiries, he was accustomed almost daily to examine them, to meet whatever difficulties they might have found, and to put himself in the attitude of an objector, with a view at once to extend their knowledge and increase their intellectual acumen. When they had gone through the prescribed course of reading, he required them to write dissertations on several subjects which had occupied their attention, afterwards sermons on those points of doctrine which he deemed most important, and finally sermons on such experimental and practical topics as they might choose to select. He was particularly earnest in inculcating the importance of a high tone of spiritual feeling, as an element of ministerial character and success. His students are said to have formed the very highest idea of his talents and character, and in some instances to have regarded him with a veneration bordering well nigh upon idolatry. Bellamy trained 100 candidates for ministry from 1742 to 1790. And there were many other pastors who made themselves available for such a ministry. Nathaniel Emmons, for example, trained 87 ministerial students from 1769 to 1840. And it should be noted that most of this training was graduate training, meaning that those coming had already attended one of the colleges. And this pattern also began to grow among early Presbyterians. Among the most notable of pastors who gave himself to the equipping of young men for the ministry was William Tennant, who founded what became known as the Law College, not far from here in the Chamonix, Bucks County. The difference here was that the men came to prepare for the ministry who did not attend one of the colleges first. And so Tennant sought to provide the basic liberal arts education as well as training for pastoral ministry. This Law College became the model for many other such training centers. For example, Samuel Blair, a graduate of Tennant's Law College, established another such institution at Fags Manor in Chester County, Pennsylvania. And from this school came Samuel Davies, later president of Princeton. Samuel Finley established another Law College at Nottingham, Pennsylvania, the most famous of whose graduates was Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was a founder of Dickinson College. Another such school was established in Peckway in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And it should be noted that an important influence in the growth of these law colleges and ministerial academies was the impact of the Great Awakening in the United States, which increased not only the number in the churches and the number of churches, but the need, therefore, for qualified ministers to care for these increasing numbers of professing Christians. Now, it was around this time that the idea of the theological seminary came into being. With the growth of this less formal approach to ministerial education, there was a decline in the number of students entering colleges with a view toward preparing for ministry. For example, of the 540 students who graduated from Yale between 1792 and 1805, only 109 were preparing for ministry, while 182 became lawyers. This trend continued. This wasn't the only problem. After the American War of Independence, notice how I worded that, Carl, the spiritual climate on the college campuses declined dramatically. Lyman Beecher described the conditions at Yale in the 1790s this way. Quote, the college was in most godly, ungodly state. The church was almost extinct. Most of the students were skeptical, and rowdies were plenty, end quote. Things weren't any better at Dartmouth, where only one member of the class of 1799 was known to be a professing Christian. So it was in this environment that the theological seminaries were founded. The first seminary in the United States was begun in New York by the Dutch Reformed Church in 1784. It later moved to New Brunswick. The Presbyterians and Congregationalists weren't far behind. The first Congregationalist seminary was established at Andover in 1807. Princeton was founded by the Presbyterians in 1812, and in 1815, Harvard expanded its professorship of divinity to a divinity school. It was the increase in demand together with a diminishing source of supply that led to the establishment of the seminaries. Now, not all ecclesiastical bodies in the United States held theological education in such high regard. As Professor Claire Davis used to say, while Presbyterians were establishing colleges, academies, and seminaries, the Baptists and Methodists were planting churches. In the beginning of the 19th century, the Methodists and Baptists were skeptical about the advantages of seminary education. The circuit-riding Methodist preacher Peter Cartwright compared the theologically educated preachers that he knew to, quote, the pale lettuce growing under the shade of a peach tree, or to a gosling that has got the wattles waiting in the dew. However, they eventually changed their tune, first as they saw the impact of the Presbyterian and Congregational graduates, and second was this consideration, the influence exerted by educated and wealthy lay people who began to demand ministers of whom they need not feel ashamed. Trained ministers, they said, were needed to attract the cultured people of the cities, and scholars were needed to refute the attacks upon their theology. In any case, the burden for training pastors shifted to theological seminaries or divinity schools attached to the existing universities. But by the middle of the 19th century, already doubts were being raised as to the effectiveness of this approach. The name Gardner Spring is known to many of you who have done study in the area of the history of theological education. He was himself a Yale graduate in the class of 1805 and had a fruitful ministry for the next 60 years in New York City. He was so well respected among Presbyterians that he became a member of the board of Princeton Seminary and held that position for many years. After he'd served on the board for 34 years, he wrote a book in 1848 entitled The Power of the Pulpit. He had some critical comments to make about the quality of the seminary's graduates, particularly in contrast to those who had experienced the old way of being trained under the tutelage of an experienced pastor. Of the change in approach, he notes, quote, "It was not unnatural that in contemplating the changes from this system of education to that which is now pursued by the theological seminaries, a doubt should have suggested itself to the minds of our fathers whether, on the whole, it would be a change for the better." And then he adds the question, "May there not be some latent defect in the modern system of educating young men for the gospel ministry?" Then he quotes Princeton faculty member Samuel Miller, who noted, quote, "how difficult it is, even in this day of theological seminaries, to supply an important vacant congregation with a pastor in whom the union of eminent learning, talents, and piety is considered indispensable," end quote. It's the sentiments of Dr. Miller that truly identify the challenge, the union of eminent learning, talents, and piety. So it's the sentiments of Dr. Miller that truly identify that, and Reverend Spring expresses this concern this way. "The age in which we live is one in which the love of learning rather than the love of Christ is easily substituted as the great stimulus to ministerial effort, in which it were not surprising if men are found occupying the sacred office whose greenest laurels are gathered from the tree of knowledge rather than from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God." He adds, "Men of letters, men of research, men of taste, and accomplished scholars who, like the rest of mankind, have the remnants of all that is unhallowed in the pride and ambition of the human heart, may look upon it as a miracle of mercy if they make not a shipwreck of a good conscience in the great work of the gospel ministry." These sentiments are echoed on our own generation by John Frame, as he writes, quote, "The academic machinery is simply incapable of measuring the things that really matter: obedience to God's word, perseverance in prayer, self-control, ability to rule without pride, the spiritual power of preaching and the conversion of people and the edification of the church," end quote. And his concern for the snares of academy, the academy model, mirror those of Gardner Spring, and perhaps put it even more forcefully, again, John Frame. Quote, "More important, such seminaries convey a false impression to the churches, to their students, and to themselves as to how the knowledge of God is attained. A person does not become qualified for the ministry simply by writing a number of good papers and memorizing enough material to pass all the exams. To give the impression that one does, as the theological academies do, is to encourage a false pride in learning, a knowledge that puffs up, a Gnosticism that in the past has led the church far from the truth of God's word." But after all that, neither Spring nor others advocate the dissolution of the seminaries. Frame, in one article entitled Proposals for a New North American Model, thought it might be good to establish Christian communities where teachers, ministerial candidates, and their families live together, eat together, work together. Teachers will ordinarily be experienced in the pastoral and or evangelistic activity. The major qualification for teachers is that they be skilled in teaching teachers. So it has to be quickly added that neither Spring nor Frame denigrate the importance of the need for Christian knowledge nor for a learned ministry. But can this perceived weakness be addressed, that concern for the union of eminent learning, talents, and piety? The pendulum seems to swing back and forth from the concern for eminent learning of the academy to the broader concerns for talents and piety seen in the apprenticeship model. Does it have to be either or? If it's agreed that all these elements are critical ingredients for preparing pastors for the gospel ministry, can the seminary be an effective means to pull them all together? I believe the answer is a qualified yes. Of course it's a qualified yes. This is Westminster. And so this brings us to the point where I introduce the four imperatives that are needed if the seminary is to be an effective place to prepare pastors. And in doing so, I hope you'll see that they seek to take advantage of the best of the academic and the apprenticeship models. And these are the four points that have been the heart of our faculty discussion lately, which has been very encouraging to us all, I believe. If the answer is to be yes, if seminary is to be a place to prepare pastors, the first thing we need to do is to renew our commitment to the mission to prepare pastors. Our brief survey of pastoral training in America has shown how important this is. When the early colleges were focused on preparing pastors, they were effective, but when their mission was bifurcated and lost in the sea of other academic pursuits, they became increasingly ineffective. This was further aggravated unintentionally by the appointment of professors of divinity, whose job it became to prepare the pastors. The mission of the institutions as a whole had changed. As the seminary movement came into full bloom, there was always and continues to be the pressure to become a graduate school of theology rather than a seminary for pastors. As Leith Anderson has written in A Church for the 21st Century, quote, traditional seminary education is designed to train research theologians who are to become parish practitioners. Probably they are adequately equipped for neither. In the apprenticeship model, the purpose was always right in front of pastor and student as they were learning from a pastor in the context of a congregation's care. But what about here at Westminster? Well, the heart of the mission of Westminster Seminary from the very beginning has been to prepare men for gospel ministry. While much that we read surrounding the beginning of Westminster focuses on the need for a new Presbyterian seminary in light of the theological liberalism at Princeton, the underlying purpose remained unchanged, to prepare men for pastoral ministry. In a brief news item in the August 3, 1929 issue of the Sunday School Times, there was an announcement about the establishment of a new seminary. And it quoted Machen, who said that in light of what was happening at Princeton, quote, we must have at least one sound source of ministerial supply, end quote. In the same publication later that month, O.T. Alice gave a brief outline of the course of studies that was to characterize the new seminary. He said, speaking of Westminster as a place for the study of the Bible as the sword of the Spirit, quote, a sword is dangerous in the hands of the unskillful, and the sword of the Spirit has a sharp edge. If the minister is to wield that sword effectively, he needs careful instruction. He was concerned about training the minister. In Machen's address delivered at the opening of the seminary the next month, as he introduced the centrality of the Scriptures to the plan for instruction, he said, quote, we believe that God has been pleased to reveal himself to man and to redeem man once for all from the guilt and power of sin. The record of that revelation and redemption is contained in the Holy Scriptures, and it's with the Holy Scriptures, not merely with the human phenomenon of religion, that candidates for the ministry should learn to deal, end quote. And there was a little booklet back then entitled Preliminary Announcements, and it was printed as the seminary began, and it noted that, get this, there's no charge for tuition or room rent. How things have changed. In describing the curriculum, it humbly states that, quote, the course of study prescribed for the certificate at the seminary, that's the description of what they granted at that time, is designed to provide a complete and symmetrical training for the gospel ministry, end quote. Westminster's first academic catalog, after recounting the unfortunate developments at Princeton, states that the seminary was founded to provide a truly evangelical and truly Presbyterian source of ministerial supply. And this purpose, foundational purpose, has been reaffirmed every time the seminary has restated its core values. For example, a few years ago, the first bullet point listed after the core values are enumerated is this: forming men for the ordained gospel ministry as pastors, teachers, evangelists, missionaries, and other tasks specified by the church. And the statement continues, reminding us it's not the only thing that we do, but it's the heart of what we do. It always has been since the seminary opened its doors. However, with that in mind, though, through the years, I've heard that said that if you want to be a scholar, go to Westminster. If you want to be a pastor, go somewhere else. But this is somewhat perplexing to me, and I think Dr. Waugh's book is going to also speak to this. It's perplexing to me, given the remarkable catalog of effective pastors who have graduated from Westminster, including more than 500 serving in the PCA, nearly 300 who have gone to serve in the OPC, and numerous other denominations and independent churches as well. And many of these turned out to be leaders in their denominations. Well, maybe it's a weakness in the Department of Practical Theology. Maybe it's all our fault. This is also perplexing to me, inasmuch as three of the most significant and lasting contributions of the seminary to the contemporary church have come through the practical theology faculty at Westminster. And I'm talking about the original Christ-centered preaching, emphasis in the rich redemptive historical approach to preaching of Clowney and Craven, the biblical counseling revolution of Adams, Bettler, Powelson, and Welch, and the remarkable work of Kahn and Ortiz in urban missions. So what about this commitment to form pastors? Well, God has blessed our seminary so that it's had to broaden its mission. It's not the only thing that we do. And this has been reflected in the addition of new degree programs through the years, some of which are designed to help us meet the opportunities to serve Christ in being a center for Christian research and scholarship. The MAR and PhD programs fit into this category and have been richly blessed in accomplishing this mission. It's important to say, therefore, that preparing pastors is not the only mission of the seminary. But when it comes to the commitment to prepare pastors, an important way we can focus is to make clear that our Master of Divinity program, as a continuation of the Bachelor of Divinity degree that ministerial students received in the old days, represents the heart of the mission of our founders, which was to prepare pastors. I understand there are students in the MDiv program who are not moving toward pastoral ministry, but it must be clear that the primary purpose of the program is ministerial preparation. And I'm pleased to say that in the most recent strategic plan, again, coming to us soon, affirms the priority of ministerial preparation. But if we are to be effective in preparing pastors, that has to be clearly stated as our mission. And that's really the foundation upon which the final three imperatives are built. The second one is to remember that our mission has to include a holistic picture of ministerial formation. What does a pastor look like? If we understand that the heart of our mission is forming men for the ordained gospel ministry, then we must understand that our goal is to form a person, not a professional. Our commitment must not be merely the transmission of information, but the transformation of character. We must have a holistic picture of ministerial formation, including, as Spring put it, eminent learning, talents, and piety. I have to hasten to add, though, that eminent learning continues to be crucial in our times. According to Eddie Gibbs, quote, there's a danger of a chasm being created between academic theology and training in ministry competencies. The challenges presented by both modernity and postmodernity require greater theologically informed discernment, not less, end quote. So I'm not suggesting for a moment that we dumb down what we do, not at all. Westminster's reputation for academic excellence should not be compromised. Our interest in academic excellence is not based on a concern, as we saw earlier, that we produce ministers whom wealthy and educated laymen are not ashamed, but rather who will be diligent to present themselves to God as workmen who do not need to be ashamed, accurately handling the Word of God. And having said that, I must add something that goes without saying, but needs to be said. We do that a lot here at Westminster. That all we do has to be grounded in an uncompromising commitment to the authority of the Scriptures. Where there's no authoritative scriptures, there's no authoritative message. Where there's no authoritative message, there's no need for a messenger. And if there's no need for a messenger, then there's no need for seminary at all. The death knell to any institution seeking to prepare pastors is the failure to uphold a robust biblical orthodoxy grounded in exemplary scholarship. To this we are committed. After all, Westminster was founded in the wake of Princeton's departure from this fundamental commitment. So if our mission is to prepare pastors, we must constantly remind ourselves of the comprehensiveness of the task to prepare a person, not a professional. The strength of the old apprenticeship model was clear here. In Archibald Alexander's wonderful history of the Law College, he wrote of Gilbert Tennent's concern for his students. Quote, but above all other things, the purity of the ministry was his care. And therefore, at the hazard of the displeasure of many, and in the face of reproach, he zealously urged every scriptural method by which carnal and earthly-minded men might be kept from entering it, and men of piety and zeal as well as learning introduced. More recently, Robert Banks warns that the current model of theological education emphasizes knowing at the expense of doing and being, and that the professional school now dominates, and this continues to ignore the being of the student, to exalt professionalism over calling and vocation. Among Westminster's core values is to develop a learned ministry set in the lifestyle of humble and holy affection for Jesus Christ. The power of the gospel should have deeply impacted the person's life. The shepherd of God's flock must understand that he himself is a sheep and dependent upon the good shepherd. He must know the Lord himself and rely on him to be fed, led, and protected. He himself must be transformed by the very word he seeks to proclaim. Sinclair reminds us of this as he writes, quote, preaching to the heart, then, is not merely a matter of technique or homiletical method or style. These things have their proper place and relevance. But the more fundamental, indeed, essential thing for the preacher, and surely the fact that something has happened to his own heart. It's been laid bare before God by his word. He, in turn, lays it bare in his ministry before those to whom he ministers. And within that twofold personal context, the goal he has in view is to so lay bare the truth of the word of God that the hearts of those who hear are opened vertically to God and horizontally to one another. A pastor should be one who maintains a vital walk with Jesus Christ, and he relies on the power of the Holy Spirit not only for power in his ministry, but also for his personal growth and conformity to the image of Jesus Christ, his shepherd. On one of George Whitfield's many visits to Philadelphia, he visited the Law College and heard Gilbert Tennent preach. Of this experience, Whitfield said, quote, "He convinced me more and more that we can preach the gospel of Christ no further than we have experienced the power of it in our own hearts," end quote. How important is this? It's crucial. We've just concluded a 5-year partnership with Covenant and Reformed Seminaries, an initiative funded by the Lilly Foundation called Sustaining Pastoral Excellence. It's an important element in the initiative was the regular gathering of cohorts of alums from all those institutions with the goal of encouraging them in their ministries. But there is also a research element in the project in which we've been able to ascertain those factors that contribute to longevity and fruitfulness in pastoral ministry. They are, in this order, spiritual formation, first. Self-development, including the renewal of their sense of calling to ministry. Emotional intelligence, including growth in emotional maturity and ability to relate to others. Marriage and family, and finally, leadership and management. Note that only one of these concerns has to do with ministry competence, as normally conceived. The others relate to spiritual formation, character development, and relationships. Now, the benefit of this kind of study helps us not only to help those who are already in ministry, but to give all of us a heads up in terms of what we need to be addressing in the seminary. Gardner Spring, in his critique of the seminary system, bemoaned the challenges of such a comprehensive approach given the sheer number of students. But it's important that we encourage every effort, including the effort of our Dean of Students, in focusing holistic ministerial formation, and all of our faculty, helping us to think of creative ways to support this direction for our students. We must remember that our task is to prepare those who, as Peter said, will prove to be examples to the flock. And I think we're making good progress in this area. A few years ago, the president of our accrediting organization, Dan Elsher, was approached by another theological institution, and he was asked about the question of spiritual formation, and he was asked if there's any seminary where they're getting it right. And guess where Dan referred that person? Westminster. Who'd have thought? But we are making progress, but we've still got a way to go. So, Westminster, a place to prepare pastors, yes, if we renew our commitment to the mission, yes, if we remember that we must focus on a holistic picture of ministerial formation. Thirdly, this is closely related to the second one, this mission has to be accomplished in partnership with the church. As I mentioned earlier, a distinct advantage of the apprenticeship model was the context of the community of faith and recognition of the importance of engagement with the church in preparing pastors. As I like to say, it takes a flock to shape a shepherd. Those first theological seminaries to which we referred earlier were founded by churches, and you would have thought that this would have been the perfect arrangement, but it didn't take long for them to slowly part ways. The relationship with the church is crucial to the formation of pastors. After all, the church is ultimately responsible to ascertain the gifts and calling of individuals for ministry. Undoubtedly, it's for this reason that our accrediting body several years ago added the requirement for supervised field education, what we know here at Westminster as mentored ministry. This required engagement with the practice of ministry in the church as a reminder that the desired outcome must include competency in the practice of ministry in the context of the church. This area of development was of concern to the founding faculty of Westminster as well, again, from the very first academic catalog under the heading Vacations. Quote, "The summer vacation gives to students a suitable opportunity for engaging in preaching and other Christian work under the direction of pastors, presbyteries, or mission boards. Such work furnishes an important supplement to the training of the seminary, affording experience and familiarity with the active duties of the ministry, which will be invaluable as a part of the preparation for the sacred office." We're blessed to have dozens of churches who partner with us in continuing to provide such opportunities, and 25 churches who are a part of our Teaching Churches Network, who are committed not only to help our students complete the field education experience required by the seminary, but to help them complete the qualifications for ordinary in their respective judicatories. Teaching churches relate to the seminary the way teaching hospitals relate to medical schools. That's the idea. Working together to sharpen and shape future pastors. So we have to continue to think creatively about how we can reinforce the strategic relationship with the church. We encourage our students. In fact, in the first semester, we require all incoming MDiv students by the end of the first semester to let us know where they're attending church when they come to Westminster. It also has to be an important priority among the faculty. Our current faculty manual requires that 75% of voting faculty be ordained teaching and ruling elders, with a majority being ordained ministers. Certainly, faculty members should be active, contributing members of the local congregation. this strengthens our relationship with the local church. I like the way Don Messner puts it in his book, Calling Church and Seminary into the 21st Century. He reminds the reader of the old academy faculty mantra, publish or perish. He suggests that what it must be in the 21st century is publish and perish. I like that. So, in addition to the connection established through mentored ministry and involvement in the local church, we will continue to seek to strengthen this connection. So, is seminary a place to prepare pastors? The answer is yes. If we renew our commitment to the mission, if we remember that we have to focus on a holistic picture of ministerial formation, and yes, if we understand that the mission has to be accomplished in partnership with the church. And finally, the fourth imperative is, for us as faculty, we need to review our approach in the classroom. If the MDiv program is designed to prepare pastors, it must have an impact on our pedagogical approach. It's not just the PT, practical theology faculty, but everyone who teaches a required course in the MDiv program has to be aware of this. We're eager to say that we give students the tools for a lifetime of ministry. That's admirable. It's not merely enough to give someone a tool. Those of you who know me well know it's not just enough to give me a tool. You have to show me how to use it, or it's very risky. Remember the words of O.T. Alice, a sword is dangerous in the hands of the unskillful, and the sword of the Spirit has a sharp edge. If the minister is to wield that sword effectively, he needs careful instruction. Richard Moo writes, quote, given the centrality of ministerial formation in the work of the seminary, it is fair to say that seminary scholarship and teaching must have a ministry-related focus, end quote. Granted, he casts the net of ministry very broadly, but his concern is that there be a certain kind of intentionality of focus. As faculty members, therefore, we have to continually ask ourselves this question, how is the way that I teach my subject preparing my students for ministry? A simple question, not an easy answer. It's been suggested that the practical theology department exists to address that concern for all departments in terms of how that material should be applied to life and ministry. I've actually heard that said. I would never want the responsibility to do this for our faculty as a whole. You wouldn't want to give me the responsibility to do this for you. Anyway, there should be no such thing as unapplied theology for any of us. So it's all the more important for all of us to make these connections, given that we live in a much more complicated world than did our founders. The challenges of the disintegrating geographical barriers of the increasingly flat world of globalization are only matched by the deteriorating moral and authoritative boundaries of postmodernism. Failing to assist our students to make these connections is to present a different kind of brute facts, or worse, brute theology. Not truth disconnected from God, but God's truth disconnected from God's world. All of us in each of our disciplines must strive to answer the so what question. We need also to be thinking about this not only with regard to our individual instruction, but we should be thinking outside the box and how we can work together as a faculty on this. The name of the article by Edward Farley that I referred to in the introduction is Why Seminaries Don't Change, A Reflection on Faculty Specialization. And he says this, quote, to the extent that seminaries imitate what American higher education expects of faculty members, they will require that faculty members be scholar teachers within the parameters of a specialized field. Tenure and promotion depend on accomplishments within this specialized field. Standards for achievement originate in and are maintained by the field itself, operating as a guild of cooperating scholars. Thus, each faculty member represents a field using a special discourse, working with certain methods, and giving priority to certain issues. He continues, specialization unavoidably inculcates a hermeneutic of suspicion toward other fields. Other fields are suspect both because their contents and methods differ, sometimes radically, from those of one's own field, and because threatening political possibilities reside in this difference. Different fields have different paradigms of knowledge, research, and interpretation. Since people believe that their own paradigm properly expresses genuine scholarship, they tend to see other paradigms as delusions and possibly even betrayals of scholarship. And they know that people in other fields view them with similar suspicion. The feeling that other faculty members do not understand or fully appreciate one's field and work is common. And this suspicion, which taints faculty relations, spawns a second suspicion of any and all potential leaders, administrative or otherwise. Deans, department chairs, and ad hoc committee chairs are by definition oriented to broader agendas and operate under broader criteria than those of one's specialty. This concern for broader welfare relativizes specialty fields and is thus suspect, end quote. So what are we to do with that? Of course, it's important for us to work in our areas of specialization. But in the seminary, we must remind ourselves and one another that we are working together toward a common goal. Back to the mission again. Are there practical ways that our partnership as faculty members around the mission can be reinforced so that we're more than loosely connected specialists who produce our piece of scholarship and hope that somehow all the pieces of the puzzle will fit together into something that resembles a pastor? An important development here in recent years has been the collaboration of departments in certain courses. For example, Biblical Studies and Practical Theology have worked together on preaching courses. And I'm pleased to announce that next spring, Dr. Edgar and I will be doing a collaborative course called Preaching and Apologetics. Or is it Apologetics and Preaching? All right. You're the senior, so I guess apologetics and preaching. And that's very encouraging. I'm very encouraged by the conversations we're having as a faculty over this issue. Another reminder to us as faculty members is that it is not only what we teach that helps prepare students for ministry, but who we are. We serve as models to those whom we teach. This is emphasized in the concluding words of one of the core values of the seminary to which I referred earlier. Quote, a learned ministry set in the lifestyle of humble and holy affection for Jesus Christ is essential in today's church and must be modeled by the board, administration, faculty, and students. If our goal is merely the transmission of information rather than the transformation of character, perhaps we could squeak by with less, but this is not the case. We must pray that through the power of the Spirit we will be models of love for God and for one another. Why is this so important? According to a study by the Duke Divinity School funded by the Lilly Foundation and published in a book entitled Pastors in Transition, Why Clergy Leave the Ministry, one of the most common reasons that Protestant pastors leave the parish ministry is the experience of troublesome conflict. A particular interest and alarm is this finding from the study. When comparing the five denominations in our study, we found pastors had higher rates of conflict with their congregations, and of the seven main reasons for leaving this type of conflict was number one in frequency among Presbyterians. The researchers didn't have any information that gave definitive answers as to why this was the case, why this was particularly problematic among Presbyterians. But if we adopted Frame's concept of theological education in the Christian community, working together, living together, perhaps things would work out a little better, but perhaps that's unrealistic. In any case, we need to be thinking about how we can work together toward this common goal. And there's certainly some truth to Robert Banks' concern that, quote, our effectiveness as teachers flows ultimately from who we are, and how we relate as much as by what we do. Unless animated by and visibly expressing the faith, love, and hope that makes our efforts effective, we do not achieve much in the classroom that endures. So in conclusion, is a seminary a place to prepare pastors? Is Westminster Seminary an effective place to prepare pastors? By the grace of God, I believe the answer is yes. And I would humbly say that Westminster continues to work on these imperatives, and it continues to provide, as our founders described, a complete and symmetrical training for the gospel ministry. And a word of personal testimony, it was 30 years ago this week that I received my MDiv from Westminster. I was in the 50th anniversary class at Westminster. And I can honestly say that having served in the ministry for 30 years as a church planter and as one involved in church revitalization and suburban ministry and urban ministry both, the Westminster Seminary prepared me well. But we can always improve. And I hope as we work on these imperatives, we will continue to be a seminary where shepherds of God's flock are effectively trained. After all, the word seminary comes from the Middle English root meaning seedbed. A seedbed is a place where a seed grows and is nurtured. And while it's ultimately the good shepherd who calls and gives gifts to those who will be his under-shepherds, we must continue to take seriously the responsibility to be his servants in helping to prepare our graduates for this lofty calling. So that on that day, when the chief shepherd appears, they will receive the unfading crown of glory. Thank you very much.